Good morning. I'm Keith Barton. I'm a member of this congregation. It's my honor to introduce our speaker today, Charisse Bock from Newburgh, Oregon. And before I get into some of the details of her biography, I'm reminded of the story of Stephen Grellet, I believe that's the right name, who was called to deliver a sermon in a clearing in Pennsylvania with no one present. And it was a rousing sermon. And unbeknownst to him, there was a man hiding in a woodpile nearby who was converted to Christianity by the by his efforts. And although we have a small number of people today, we have far more than Stephen Grellet had. And moreover, some of us are going to be taking notes to distribute. I talked to several people who expressed regrets for not being here, but enthusiastically requested any notes that we might have. So maybe Tomi and I can prepare a summary of the proceedings and distribute this the insights that Charisse will bring to us wide and far. In case anyone has missed it, the bathrooms are up the stairs and to the left, and there will be food available at the break, lunch break, which will be around 12:30. We'll have a couple of sessions of talk before the lunch break and one afterwards, with the aim to close around 3:15. If people want to linger and discuss the subject matter of the day, I think we could find a place either in that corner where we could gather and do that, or in the fellowship hall where the seating is actually more comfortable. And on the other hand, if people need to, you know, rush back home, that's perfectly understandable. And I suspect there will be food left over from lunch to snack on as well at that time. Charisse Bock lives in Oregon, where she attends the North Valley Friends Church. She is the clerk of Sierra Cascade Yearly Meeting of Friends, which is a new yearly meeting that is forming in the Pacific Northwest and possibly might include parts of California as well. It was created by a schism within Northwest Yearly Meeting over the matters of sexual minorities within Northwest Yearly Meeting, which many people found unscriptural. So the ejected faction has formed, is in the process of forming a yearly meeting. And Charisse has graciously offered to clerk that yearly meeting. And they've had two quarterly meetings since their formative meeting last July, which I was favored to attend. Perhaps in the discussion that follows this, that we might have an opportunity to explore a current status of Sierra Cascade yearly meeting. She is also an adjunct professor at George Fox University, which is a school in Newburgh operated by Northwest Yearly Meeting. She teaches in the seminary, which I believe is Pacific? Portland Seminary. After having acquired a Master's of Divinity at Princeton Theological Seminary. She teaches topics on spirituality, social justice, creation care, Quakerism, Christian mysticism, the Bible, and church history. She also coordinates the community garden at George Fox University. She is pursuing a PhD at Antioch University in New Hampshire, and I believe we'll be finishing this year, perhaps, if all goes well. And she is honored to serve as a regenerate fellow at the Wake Forest School of Divinity's Food, Faith, and Religious Leadership Initiative, and as a Green Faith Fellow. She was a scholar in residence at Reedwood Friends Church in Portland in 2017. She edits Environmental Studies, a journal called Whole Terrain, and facilitates web content for the Watershed Disciplineship website, which is a ministry of the Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries. Her hobbies include raising fruits and vegetables and chickens, hiking and camping. She loves to listen to audiobooks while she does housework. And she and her husband, Joel, have two children, two boys, ages 11 and 7. She sees Quaker faith reflected in environmental concerns as one of this generation's most important social justice issues, and she focuses her academic and ministerial work at the intersection of theology, peace, and justice issues and environmental care. So with that information, I'm looking forward to her presentations today on ecology and the Quaker movement.
Thank you. It's good to be with you all. So thank you for having me. It's fun to see this meeting house and see all of your faces and connect with all of you as we're kind of going through some transition as friends right now. In this time, it's good to make connections with one another and to find the light within one another as we travel and learn from one another and fellowship together. So thank you for inviting me here, and it's great to be able to continue this tradition of traveling among friends. So thank you. And I also bring greetings from my meeting North Valley Friends Church. So greetings to you all from them. So I'll start off with telling you a little bit about myself and how I got interested in this topic. So I am a lifelong Quaker. I grew up in Newburgh, Oregon, which is kind of one of those Quaker meccas that that are kind of spread out across the country. And so I grew up going to an unprogrammed meeting that was part of Northwest Yearly Meeting, which is kind of unusual, but my parents and some of their friends started an unprogrammed meeting in Newburgh when I was just before I was born. And we went there for about 10 or 12 years. And then we went to a programmed meeting because they had a youth group. so I went over to that group at Newburgh Friends Church in Newburgh as well. And I've always felt like as I came to my faith and my Quakerism on my own terms, I felt like the Quaker way of connecting the Bible and personal experience with community is what feels like the best place for me. And so I found that that was a really important community for me to continue to journey with, and became kind of a convinced friend then as well. And I feel like as I made that journey, some of the things that were really important to me were the history of friends and the traditions that we've had of social justice and of caring for the people around us and the issues of our time that are the most important and most pressing. And so as I grew up, I kind of started to wonder, well, what is the most important justice issue of our time? What should we as friends be working on at this point in history? And so I thought a lot about that and prayed a lot about that and looked at various issues, social justice issues, and there are plenty of them to care about, right, unfortunately. I spent some time with Christian peacemaker teams. I went on a delegation to Israel and Palestine and learned about the conflict there and the work of Christian peacemaker teams to do reconciliation and accompaniment with, particularly with Palestinians who are not being treated justly in that space. And while they're doing amazing work and it's really important, I felt called to come home and work on those kinds of things here, to not try to fix somebody else's problems over there, but work on the things at home. What are the justice issues that we have here in our place and in our communities? And as I spent more time discerning about this and looking at all of the issues going on, I started to also at the same time become more and more aware of what's going on with our planet and the environmental degradation that's happening and climate change that is occurring, and learning more about that, as well as just noticing the ways that we're treating the land around us and the water and the air. And also seeing that not only as something that has to do with the other species and the land and the other natural resources around us, but that has to do with the people that we're around and the ways that that we treat the environment really reflect the ways that we treat other people. So it really reflects how we treat women, how we treat minority groups, and how we treat the natural world. They all pretty much line up with the way that we use things as a disposable object instead of seeing the humanity or the subjecthood of the individual or the other species around us. So as I started noticing those connections, that intersection between all of those issues, I noticed that if we don't have a healthy environment, it's going to be difficult to work on any of those other social justice issues, right? So that's, for me, the heart of why this is an important topic, that all of these things are connected. We can't really work on our justice issues without also addressing the environmental concerns, creating a safe and healthy place for us to live. And I feel like that is not only just intellectually important, like, okay, this makes rational sense, but it's a sense of calling, too, from my faith as a Christian and as a Quaker. And so today I want to share with you a little bit about how I see those two things connected, the environmental concerns, the justice concerns, and the pieces of Quaker and Christian tradition that I think flow together and bring those all together. So for some of you, maybe you come from a Quaker tradition that doesn't focus on the Bible and Christ as much, and I hope that you will hear this as an encouragement that there are actually Christians that care about the environment and that there are positive things in the Bible about creation care and caring for this place that God has put us in. And so so I hope you will hear it as something that will encourage you to take a look at those scriptural passages if that's something that you're drawn to, but also just to know there are people that that are Christians and that are working on these things, and that there it's not mutually exclusive. You can find these things within the Christian tradition and within the Christian scriptures. And for those of you who maybe are interested in the environment and are Christians, but you haven't necessarily thought of them together as part of your faith journey, hopefully this will encourage you to look into that a little bit more deeply as well. How do these things fit together? They're not just I do my environmental stuff over here and I do my faith stuff over here, but how do they fit together as I'm doing this care for the planet out of a sense of this is a calling from God to care for this place that I've been placed in? So that's kind of my hope for today, is that we can look at this together as an opportunity to see how we are called in this particular time, in this particular place, to care for the creation which God has placed us in. So the Judeo-Christian story starts with a garden and places the people in it to care for it and to be participants in that space and to meet God there. And so I wonder if we can just take a moment to be still. And I invite you to think back across your life to a time when you suspect that maybe you met God or the divine in the natural world. So close your eyes and think back to a space where you encountered God or what you think might have been the divine in the natural world. Imagine yourself in that place. What was it like to be there? What did you notice? What did that divine encounter feel like? I invite you to just shout out one word that explains something about that experience.
Beautiful.
Beautiful.
Holy.
Holy. Mm-hmm.
Joy.
Joy.
Alive.
Clarity and awe.
Enormity,
yeah.
Connection. Mystery.
Light. Mm-hmm.
Humble,
yeah.
Rest.
I invite you to soak in those feelings and to bring those with you throughout the day as we have these discussions, and to remember that God becomes present to us in this place, in our bodies, in this world. So go ahead and open your eyes and continue with that mind frame and that feeling. And I think that sets the stage for who we are and who we want to be in the world as friends, right? A lot of those words, I think, describe who we want to be. We want to be people who are open to the mystery, the awe, the wonder, the space of rest and being able to create something beautiful. So kind of makes you wonder why we meet in buildings at all, but we'll leave that one for another day. But just that sense of there is something different about connecting with God through the natural world, which isn't always the case. Sometimes the natural world is scary and dark and not necessarily positive, but a lot of times we can connect with something larger than ourselves and outside of ourselves when we're paying attention in those natural spaces. All right, so today we're going to, in this first session, discuss the idea of an eco-reformation. So I'm using that term, but you probably haven't heard it before. So I'll give a little bit of a rundown of what that is and talk about how the idea of environmental care is based in Christian scripture and tradition, and how it's sorely needed to be addressed in a systemic way in our time and place. In the second session, I'll describe the ways that Christian theology and Quaker tradition helps and sometimes hinders us in putting environmental care into action. And in the third session, I'll talk about how we're participating, how we can hopefully participate in an eco-reformation through something called watershed discipleship, which I think is a helpful way of understanding creation care within a Christian and faith-based framework that I will share about. And it has to do with bringing together justice issues, environment, and Christian tradition to put steps into action for living more sustainably. There's also a bonus session tomorrow. If you come to worship, I will be preaching, and so if you come back tomorrow, I will be sharing tomorrow morning about hope. And so a lot of this stuff about the environment can get a little depressing and difficult to deal with, of wondering how do we even deal with all this huge topic. And so I'll be using a parable from the New Testament and explaining some of the understandings of the word for hope in the Christian tradition and the Jewish tradition. So if that sounds interesting to you, come back tomorrow. So first, what do I mean by an eco-reformation? So I got this term from the Lutherans, but don't hold that against me. So in the time of the Protestant Reformation, the major issue that they were working on at that time was describing what salvation looked like, right? So are you saved by faith or by works? And who gets to be saved? Is it the elect? Is it only a few people? Or is everybody available, allowed to be saved? And those kinds of questions. And so we went through that and kind of worked through those issues. It had to do with hierarchy and kind of flattening out the hierarchy. And so that was the great work of that time, was to kind of democratize faith. And in our time, the ecological situation is the great work of our time. And this isn't limited to people of faith, of course. We all have a piece in that, especially in the countries that use the most resources. But as people of faith, what is our role? And is there something that we can offer as Christians or as Quakers that is particular to us and to our tradition and that helps us to live out care for the planet out of the ways that we have come to know how to be a community together? So this eco-reformation needs to be comprehensive and systematic. It's not just us doing individual actions and hoping that it makes a difference, but working together to reform the whole system and the whole way that we think. So not just, you know, how can I do something that's a little bit more efficient, but how can I reform the whole way that we are thinking about what it means to be the people of God? And just like the Reformation reformed the ways that we thought about the church hierarchy, can we extend that out into recognizing that we're part of an ecosystem, part of this created world, and this is the place in which God connects with us? So there's a quote from this Eco-Reformation book that I wanted to read for you that says, "Without losing the foundational fruits of that revolutionary Reformation and building on them to address our current context, we need a new Copernican revolution." So something as mind-blowing as shifting to that Copernican worldview where the sun doesn't go around the earth, but the earth goes around the sun, right? From human-centered to being creation-centered, from focusing on God's relationship with humans alone to focusing on God's relationship with all of creation, from fostering the extreme individualism of our culture to fostering the common good of the planet. We humans need to see ourselves embedded in the rest of nature and find our proper place and role in it, both our responsibilities and our limitations. And this is not exactly a new concept. That's why we can call it a reformation, because we're reforming back to something that we have understood and that we maybe have forgotten or not put as much focus on. So this is something that is present within our tradition. And this is kind of an exciting time to be alive, but also kind of terrifying, right? Because we have this great opportunity in front of us to be part of something new, something that is emerging in our faith communities. And that's great, but it's also challenging. So as Keith mentioned, my little branch of Quakerism split recently, and we're having to figure out what it looks like to be Quakers in this time and place in new ways. And that's not always easy and not always comfortable. And it takes us outside of our comfort zone. It takes some work to figure out what does it look like when we actually follow what the Spirit of God is doing rather than just following the things that we've done for years, right? So how do we discern where the Spirit is moving rather than just continuing on doing the same things that we've always done? But at the same time, we can learn from our traditions. And so even though we don't necessarily like Mr. Augustine here all the time, he every once in a while said some intelligent things. So I'll read this quote. I forgot to put it on my paper. I guess I have this one. So Augustine said, "Others, in order to find God, will read a book. Well, as a matter of fact, there is a certain great big book, the book of created nature. Look carefully at it, top and bottom. Observe it. Read it. God did not make letters of ink for you to recognize God in. God set before your eyes all these things God has made. Why look for a louder voice? Heaven and earth cries out to you, God made me. Observe heaven and earth in a religious spirit." So it's this idea that when we look for God, I can turn this on. Is this better? No. Sorry, it's not working. No, it's a red light.
Uh-oh.
Okay. So you can read the quote there. But this idea that there's the Bible, which is a helpful tool in learning about the story of people connecting with God across time, and there's also the book of created nature, where we can see God in the natural world and connect with God, whether or not we have that written word or not. That's a pretty Quakerly thing to say, right? We all probably believe that we can encounter God in our own experience. That's how George Fox came to understand God in a real way. Even though he had read the Bible so many times, he needed that personal experience when he's out spending the night in a haystack, right? So now we're getting feedback. So this sense that there's the written word that is helpful, and there's also the book of created nature, which also helps us. So when we have both of them, that gives us twice as many places where we can look for and find God. And this was not an original concept to him either. So there were a lot of people expressing this kind of sentiment back in the early days of the church. So for the rest of the session, we're going to look at creation care themes in the Bible, because I think a lot of times we hear about Christians who say that we're against creation care. God gave us this planet to use up, and so we should use it up as fast as we can so Jesus will come back, which is not a very good correct reading of Scripture. So we'll not even worry about that today, but we'll look at the positive things in the text that do point to the importance of caring for creation. So within the creation stories in Genesis 1 and 2, obviously there's quite a bit about creation in those stories. I know, shocking. Okay, so within the creation story, we have God creating people, male and female, in the first story, in Genesis 2, God creates the one person, Adam, which means human being. And then when they're separated, they become Ish and Isha, man and woman. And so it's this human being who is created within this garden, created as somebody that God particularly puts God's image into. And Adam is fairly close to the Hebrew word for soil or dirt, which is Adama. So God creates this person out of dirt, and it retains a lot of the properties of soil and has a linguistic connection to that Hebrew term, as well as kind of this humility reminder, right? But it's the sense that we're created from the soil. We're part of this place. We are created from the very soil and God's breath. And God gives us the plants to eat, and then eventually the animals. At first, God creates them vegetarian, but
we'll let you meat eater slide, because he does eventually give us the meat. But God gives us the plants and the animals to eat, but doesn't actually give the land, which is interesting. If you go back and read Genesis 1 and 2, God gives them the animals and plants to eat, but there's nothing that says that God gives them the land. So eventually God does give a piece of land to the Israelites as they're moving forward, as long as they're keeping their covenant with God. So the land-based covenant is important, that as long as they're treating the land well, then they have the right to be on that land. But in this original story, the land is God's, and the people are stewards of it. People are told to be fruitful and multiply. We hear that pretty often, but we forget that also God told the fish and the birds and the other animals to be fruitful and multiply as well. It wasn't just the people. All right, so human beings in Genesis 1 and 2 are given responsibility to care for the earth, to till it and to keep it, and to become skilled masters of it. So that word that we a lot of times translate dominion is radah, and it means skilled mastery, like an art or a craft. So as opposed to dominion over, where you have control over something in a dominating way, it's more of a, you've mastered it, you've become skilled at it, you've learned how to craft that thing, as if you're a wood craftsman and you learn to craft beautiful furniture or that sort of thing. That's more of the sense of having mastered a skill rather than having power over something. And this is a very different story from the order versus chaos stories of the communities around them. So the Babylonian creation myth has this story where the mother goddess has to be destroyed and cut into pieces in order for the earth to be created. So the broken body of the mother goddess becomes the earth in the Babylonian creation myth, which obviously has a lot of not so good implications for ways of treating women and the planet. And that is different from the Hebrew story. So in the Hebrew story, God creates out of the things that are floating around in the nothingness, in the void, and calls it good. It doesn't have to create out of destruction, but creates out of life-giving creativity. And people fit into that and are part of it. They're not separate from it. So while I'll skip to the law section, I could talk about covenant for a while, but talked about that a little bit, and if you want to hear more sometime, I can tell you more, but I teach whole classes on this stuff, so I have to like condense it down into three sessions. So I'll try to go quickly here. But in the law, we kind of think of the law in the Hebrew scriptures as this, like, you have to live this way, structured, and it's really legalistic. But in the original intent of it, the focus was on building a community where the people could be safe. So people are emerging out of Egypt, and they're wondering how are they going to be a community together in a safe and healthy way as they've emerged from slavery and domination in Egypt. How do they create a community now as they're wandering in the wilderness? How do they create and establish a community once they have a place to live? So the focus is on being a safe community where everybody can know where they're at in that community, giving everybody rest, and trusting God that there will be enough. There's a lot of required trust as they're wandering in the wilderness for 40 years, right? They have to trust that God is going to provide food for them, trust that even if they don't go and gather food on the Sabbath, that there's going to be enough. Trust that God is the one leading them, that they're not just lost in the wilderness for 40 years, right? And there's, throughout it all, this sense of shalom or wholeness. So shalom, we usually translate to mean peace, but it's more than our sense of, like, absence of violence. It's a holisticness. It's a whole community coming together to build shalom and to make sure that everybody has enough. Everybody can trust one another, that there's a community that is healthy. And so all of these put together are the intention of the law, the intention behind the law. Now, whenever we start practicing laws, we end up, you know, making them legalistic and they lose their positive impact. But the intention behind it is building that shalom community. And that includes the land and the animals. So there are specific rules about how to treat the land and how to treat the animals. Everybody in the community gets rest on the Sabbath, even the animals.
So within the law, you can see, like in Leviticus 25 and Deuteronomy 15, they call for a Sabbath year, a sabbatical year for the sake of the land. So we practice that to some degree with crop rotation now, and they're getting that idea from God that they need to allow the land rest. They also talked about a year of Jubilee, which we think of for people, which was great for the economic system and the social system to have a hard reset every 50 years. And there's also a hard reset for the land. So you let everything go fallow, you eat what grows on the land, and you've saved up from previous years so that you have enough for that year. And there's this year of Jubilee and celebration of everybody going back to a right relationship with the land and with one another, with their community. And there's a requirement that the land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine, says God. With me, you are but aliens and tenants. So this over and over reminder that the land belongs to God, that even though God gives the land for a certain amount of time, it's based on right treatment of the land. And that we're the tenants, we're the stewards, we're the people who are the caretakers of that land. And we need to allow that land to be healthy. Within the prophets, you see a lot, we notice that they're critiquing the economic system and the social system, and to some extent the religious system a lot of times. And then they're also offering hope for renewal. So they're not just being critical, but they're offering hope that God is going to come in and that God has a better vision than what is happening right now. It's very land-based, so I think we miss this a lot when we're reading through the Hebrew Scriptures or the Christian Testament. We see the stuff about the people, but we miss the part about the land because we're not attuned to pay attention to it. So I don't know if you've all seen the Green Bible, but it's it highlights all the passages that are about the land and creation and other species. And so pick that up and leaf through it sometime if you run across it in a bookstore or something. But it's pretty interesting how much is in there about the land and the creation that we just don't think about because we just aren't paying attention, but it's really there. So a lot of the things that the prophets say have to do with noticing that the land is not being treated well, and that's a mark of the community not following the law properly. So the theme of the wilderness is a major theme that runs through the Bible too, and throughout early church history particularly, and even in our day, people go out into the wilderness to have divine encounters, right? And so you see this theme of people finding God in the wilderness in so many places within the Bible. So I listed a few. So the Israelites are wandering in the wilderness, and the prophets often get kicked out of wherever they're living out into the wilderness and don't have a choice, but they find God there. And Jesus, well, I guess John the Baptist first, John the Baptist goes out into the wilderness and invites everyone to come out into the wilderness to be baptized and to encounter God outside of the religious centers of the cities. And then Jesus, of course, goes out into the wilderness often, or at least outside. I don't know if you'd call it wilderness, but he spends time outside. He leaves the community of people and goes out into the garden or across the lake or wherever he can find some place to be by himself outside to encounter God. Paul, actually, there's a reference to him leaving and going and spending a couple years out in the wilderness in Egypt before he starts his missionary journeys, which we don't always notice, but as we've started paying attention to this more as scholars, people have picked that up. And then you've got the desert fathers and mothers, so these early Christians going out into the desert, into the wilderness to say, how can we find God? How can we kind of move out of the unhealthy systems of our time and find a place where we can really follow God and focus on God solely? And so they go out into the wilderness to do that. St. Francis, you've probably heard of him. He had a very heavy focus on other species and caring for those around him that weren't necessarily humans as well as the human beings around him. So you've got this kind of thread that goes throughout all of Jewish and Christian history of people encountering God in the wilderness, when they go there intentionally or when they're following God and, you know, get kicked out of their places and have to go somewhere else. So it's a place that is a theme for the ways that we find God. So then there's Jesus, and his very incarnation in a lot of ways speaks to the fact that we can learn about God through creation and through our bodies. So I think this is something that we kind of take for granted a lot of times, that, okay, yeah, Jesus became person. Jesus became matter, became flesh, became part of this ecosystem and ate stuff and had waste, I would imagine, and was just part of what it's like to live here on this planet. There are also themes of, when he institutes communion with the elements, which we as good Quakers probably don't do very often, but, he's using the physical elements of that place, the things that grow out of that land to symbolize the body and blood of God. And there's this importance of food and table fellowship, so sharing meals with people that are from different social classes and different religious groups, and being willing to show that they can be a part of the same community by sharing the table together, sharing food with one another, and fellowshipping with each other around food. Those sorts of things help us to recognize the importance of really being in our bodies and being present to this place in which we live. This passage from Romans 8 has come to kind of be a creation care passage in the last several years, as people have thought about the implications of this passage. So it says, "For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now, and not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. For in hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience." So this idea that salvation is not only for human beings, but all of creation waits with eager longing for salvation, for this reconciliation of God and people and the rest of the created order. And the creation itself is experiencing labor pains. And that, to me, indicates that we're trying to birth new life together. We're trying to birth the new life that comes from the Spirit together with the created world, not just human beings, but all of this that God has created, working together to birth the new creation. And finally, we've got the end times, which is not always a topic that is easy for Christians to deal with in terms of caring for creation. But I will just say about this that there is not a whole lot in the biblical text that tells us exactly what's going to happen in the end times, despite many books being written that try to tell us what's going to happen, right? But this idea that that there's this new heaven and new earth in Revelation is actually a physical place. It's not just that everything is going to be destroyed and something new is going to be created, but like this physical new Jerusalem descends, and the creation itself is renewed. So there's not actually anything that says the earth is going to be destroyed. There is stuff about there being fire, but I mean, Southern California is experiencing fire more frequently anyway. So those sorts of things doesn't necessarily mean the entire planet is going to be destroyed, even if you read the biblical text literally. So the point being that what we do have within Revelation is this picture of a river of life and a tree of life that are the central points of this new creation that that is being brought into existence. And so so it's the river and the tree that are the anchor points of that new life. And they represent life, that without water, healthy water, without growing trees that help cycle the oxygen for us, the redemption of our bodies that it mentions in this Romans 8 passage can't happen. So I don't think that you have to believe in the actual redemption of our actual bodies, you know, with all the same molecules or that sort of thing, because that gets a little bit weird scientifically. But this sense that our bodies have something important to do with the salvation story, with the process of becoming new creatures, that it's not just about our spirits going to be with God somewhere else, but there is something important about this physical space, the physical place in which we live, and the bodies in which we live, that they aren't for burning and for destroying, but they're for being renewed. And they're part of that process of renewal along with the rest of creation. So I think here in this area of Berkeley and San Francisco, I don't have to probably substantiate that we're overusing our resources and we're experiencing climate change. But just to say that we as Americans are contributing to the overuse of resources, whether we want to or not at this point. And right now, we are already, as a global population, using over 1.5 of the amount of resources that the Earth produces each year, because we're using resources that took more than a year to be created, right? So we're already using that much as a global community. And as Americans, people have calculated that if everybody, all the humans on the planet, were using as many resources as Americans do, that we would need 4 Earths every year to sustain us. And some countries are even worse, unfortunately. We're not number one. Oh, wait. But so we're using way more resources than are being produced. So we're going to have to deal with that at some point. And at the same time as we're as our ecological footprint is going up and we're using more resources, the biocapacity of the planet is going down, because, like, if you think about fishing and how if we fish all the big fish and then there are no fish left to reproduce, then there's going to be fewer and fewer fish, right? So the things like that are happening all over different ecosystems, and the biocapacity is going down as we use up more and more fossil fuels. The return on energy invested in getting those fossil fuels out of where they are compared to how much we can, you know, how much usefulness they give us when we use them is going down, because we've gotten all of the easy ones. So the biocapacity in all various sectors is going down as our use of resources is going up. Add to that that this is not just an issue across the board that impacts all of us the same way, but particularly people of color in the United States end up feeling the brunt of environmental concerns more than white folks do in the United States. And then if you take that out globally, people in the global south and in developing nations bear the brunt of environmental concerns more than people in the first world or the developed world. So this is a justice issue, because, you know, folks don't want to have environmentally polluting things in their backyard, so they send it someplace else to a community that doesn't have as much political power, economic power, or, you know, that needs the development dollars if they're in another country or that sort of thing. So this is something that that a lot of us who are privileged to live in Berkeley, perhaps, or to be Americans, for sure, need to recognize that this is not just something that that we can say, oh yeah, all of us are experiencing this together, but some of us are experiencing environmental concerns more than others already, and something that we need to be aware of, and brings it together particularly with our history of standing for social justice causes as Quakers. All right, so that brings us to the need for an eco-reformation. So in the original Reformation, there is this democratizing of the church hierarchy. And in this Reformation, I think there needs to be a reform of our understanding of who we are in relation to the rest of creation, and a humility of being part of what God has created, not being above it. So I forgot I had a picture of Martin Luther here for the original Reformation, and then George Fox with his experience of God out in the natural world, recognizing that God can speak to us directly. But as we head into this eco-reformation, I like this graphic about sustainability and the triple bottom line of putting together the social, the economic, and the environmental spheres, and in the middle of that is sustainability. And I also see that as shalom, as that place of wholeness that we're aiming for, that the Bible invites us into. And so so we as Quakers have tended to do or focus on the social and the economic, right? So we're aiming for that place that says equitable. We're aiming for equity in the middle there. We don't always hit the target, but at least we're working on it. But adding in that ecological piece, I think, is important to be able to not just aim for equity between people and then continuing to use up resources, but recognizing that there's also this piece of the health and safety and ability to thrive for all people and other species, because we need them in order to continue to survive well on this planet. And God created them as part of this whole system. And I think we have a unique opportunity as people of faith that we have these pieces within our tradition that help us to recognize these are values that we have that are continuing throughout history to remind us of how we connect with God through the natural world, of the balance that happens when we hit that shalom, sustainable core, and putting all those pieces together. So if we can recover those things from our tradition and remember the importance of the land and the other creatures, I think it will help us as we work on all of the other justice issues in our context as well. So that is that's the first section of the talk. And in the next section, we'll be kind of going over some of the more negative aspects of Christian theology and Quaker thought, as well as some of the potentials and positive things. So thank you, and I think we have a 15-minute break, and then we'll be back in a little bit.